to fight for, what we're willing to organize around. And those are very important conversations to have, and ones that we should be having all the time. We should know what it means to work in a fully funded school system and what it means for kids to have what they actually need, like what every kid actually needs and deserves.
Absolutely.
And we should know how to get there, and we should be able to have conversations about what that journey looks like and how to fight for those things. And I guess that's where we'll have to end.
Ending on a positive note. Thank you, Rachel.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for joining us on KBOO tonight. Thanks to our new engineers, and thank you, Stephen. Thank you, audience, for tuning in tonight. This is Rachel Haynes. You've been listening to Labor Radio. Tune in next Monday and every Monday at 6 to catch another Labor Radio show.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Sketchy Beats PDX on Sunday, May 19th from 1 to 4 at Nucleus Portland. Sketchy Beats PDX is a community event that brings together visual and sonic artists to draw together while listening to live sets from local beatmakers. This event is a benefit for Friends of Noise, working to create all ages venues in Portland, and Momentum Alliance. Again, that's Sketchy Beats PDX, a fundraiser for Friends of Noise and Momentum Alliance, on Sunday, May 19th from 1 to 4 p.m. at Nucleus Portland, 1445 Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Isabel Sinclair, and today we have three marvelous guests with us here to talk about the Family Preservation Project and motherhood inside of Coffee Creek. So today we have Jessica Katz, who's the director for the Center of Incarcerated Mothers, which is responsible for bringing the Family Preservation Project into Coffee Creek, and Heather Rolette, the project coordinator for the Family Preservation Project, and Ebony Howard, a formerly incarcerated mother who is also on the advisory board for the Center for Incarcerated Mothers. Jessica, if you'd like to start us off by describing a little bit what FPP does within Coffee Creek, that would be wonderful.
So the Family Preservation Project is one of several programs that we offer at Coffee Creek and through the Center for Incarcerated Mothers. And so there is an intensive family reunification program, which is known as the Family Preservation Project. And then in addition, we have a family resource center, which is open to many more women who have any barriers to parenting. And then we have a monthly lecture series where we're trying to reach whoever's interested in coming to learn something new. And the topics center around parenting, legal issues, reentry issues, and well-being. And so our hope over the years has been to remove barriers to people receiving services as to the extent that we can. So the lecture series is an open call out. So whoever's on site and interested in coming is welcome to come. Our hope is that they learn something or leave feeling more hopeful, or something happens that restores something in them that they can maybe do the next thing. Because what we have encountered over the years is just a lot of hopelessness and stuckness. And so that anyway, the hope for the lecture series is just to serve as many people as possible. And at its core, the services, the whole array of services that we offer, are in response to what we know happens collaterally as consequences to incarceration, particularly with mothers, and the intersectionality that creates, and all of the consequences that it creates. So we are essentially there to help mitigate against the consequences and to help families stay intact, and ultimately to interrupt cycles that have happened in families generationally that haven't served anyone very well. So our lens is really around the children and what they may suffer as a result of their mom disappearing for years. And we believe that the vehicle to preserving well-being for children is to provide their mom with everything that she needs to be able to do the job that is an arduous job.
In your time working in Coffee Creek, about how much of the population would you say are mothers? And what are some of the most noticeable consequences that you see a lot of mothers struggle with?
So statistically, what we understand is 84% of mothers, 84% of women at Coffee Creek are mothers. And I would say consequences are probably the most dire consequences. Being stripped of all of your identities that you had prior to coming there. And motherhood being a very significant identity, and really having that called into question, whether you're capable of being a mother, whether you're worthy of being a mother, whether you deserve to be a mother. I think all of these things come into the conversation. And because most children were living with their mothers prior to her incarceration, we see a lot of instability with children of incarcerated mothers. They tend to change placements multiple times, schools multiple times. And what we know is when a father's incarcerated, they generally get to see their children because their mother brings them, and that's not true in the reverse. So we see years on end of children just not being able to see their mom. And when they do finally get to see their mom, they can't really touch her because you're in a prison visit. And if you're over the age of 7, you can't sit on your mom's lap and you can't have extensive physical contact. And I think it just leaves a lot of unanswered questions for children, and it's pretty hard for them to wrap their heads around. And so what we're trying to do is, for the moms and the children, to create a coherent narrative about what's happening, and that it's not that mom's not a bad person, that they didn't do anything wrong. So really trying to work around that narrative for both moms and kids.
So from what you're describing, it sounds like one of the largest impacts that incarceration has on motherhood is this sort of like the psychological, the stigma and shame, and then the separation of a mother and child. So it sounds like you're doing work to reverse that, to help connect mothers with their children again.
Mm-hmm. And also the stuckness, the being stuck in that place and things happening, you know, like the way time takes on a very different element when you're inside and life marches on outside. So a plan that you make when you're looking at spending 3 years inside may change 10 times. And I see moms being inside, knowing what needs to happen, having the solutions, having been the one that would have solved all the problems, but being stuck. So essentially what we're trying to do is just help moms be unstuck to do the things that they know how to do.
I wonder if this would be a good time to transition and ask you, Ebony, from your experience working with FPP while you were incarcerated at Coffee Creek, would you be willing to share what you were looking for when you went to the program, and what help did you receive, and how did that impact your experience in Coffee Creek?
So my experience at Coffee Creek dealing with the Family Preservation Project, I was looking for support. I was looking for guidance. I was looking for help to break down these seemingly impenetrable walls between me, myself, and my attorney or my DHS social worker, and to get to the other side where I could have some type of contact with my children. And being incarcerated, there's no option to make a phone call on your own. You know, the DHS offices, you call them, they have a recording that first answers, or you get a voicemail, and you can't utilize those avenues with a prepaid calling, you know, with a calling collect call system. calls are 16 cents a minute and you need funds for that, and there's no way to connect because there's not an actual person on the other line. Same thing goes for getting in touch with your attorney or anyone who is supposed to be of service to you while you're dealing in, with your case and navigating the courts. Without the intervention of the Family Preservation Project, I know for a fact my family wouldn't be what it is today, because with their intervention, I was afforded an avenue where I could communicate with the people that were on the other side, the gatekeeper, so to speak, when it came to getting in touch or connecting with my child. And without that form of communication, I would have lost my rights and lost access to my child long ago. And I'm very, very grateful for that program, and I hope that they will be able to be sustained indefinitely to provide further services for other of those 84% that are currently incarcerated that have children out there that they are not in touch with.
So I heard you mention that you could have lost the rights to children, and could you describe a little bit what that means and how that would have happened?
Yeah, so there's a statute or a law in place that says if you're incarcerated for such and such amount of time that they automatically pursue termination of your parental rights. And as a parent incarcerated, the courts don't see you as a parenting option for your child, so they kind of write you off. Oh, you're on a back shelf and you're not really what we're looking for a sustainable plan for your child. So you have to prove through your own efforts that you are in fact an able option for your child in the future. And that fight is very daunting, and it's made very, very challenging, and it's very prohibitive from inside, because you don't have the phone communication, you don't have the written communication, you don't have a way to show that you are serious about doing something different with your life, or you do care and love your children despite the choices that you made that got you to where you're at. If I hadn't had that avenue of communication, I wouldn't have known about my son transferring from foster home to foster home. He was in 8 placements during my 3-year incarceration. And the things that they come at you with for you to prove that you're the parenting option that's best for your child, can be pretty ridiculous. They told me I needed to learn sign language because my son had a hearing impairment. If I didn't learn sign language, I wasn't a great parent for my son. They told me at one point I needed to lose weight to be a good parent for my son. And they tried it 8 different times. They had different placements, but they tried 8 different times subsequently to adopt my son to different families. And throughout my 3-year term of incarceration, every one of those fell through. And I came to a point where they brought me paperwork and asked me to sign away the rights to my child. And my attorney brought the paperwork. I was in that little room myself again with all these, you know, legal professionals telling me that this is for my child's best interest, and I needed to go ahead and do that. And I did sign the papers, but I asked my attorney to hold on to them for 2 weeks. And then I would have that window of time to think about it. And the very next day, I reached out through the Family Preservation Project and contacted my attorney and asked her to tear up the papers. And I chose to fight for my child. But so many women don't have that, aren't allowed to have that foresight to consider what will happen 10 years down the road if my child comes to me and says, you know, why did you do this? Or why weren't you there? And I wanted to be able to look at my child and tell them that I did everything I could in the moment to be available to parent them, you know, for their lifetime. And when you do agree to go out for court involving children, you're giving up your job placement. You're giving up your housing placement. At the time of my trial for my son and my parental rights, I was in the treatment program at the prison, and that treatment program afforded me an earlier release date than I was currently looking at completion of that program. But I was willing to give up the potential to be involved in that program to get released early in order to go out to face a trial for the rights of my children, or my parenting rights concerning my child. If I had chosen not to go out to trial, I would have automatically lost my rights. But then the alternative was I could have guaranteed my place in treatment, gotten the services that DHS said that I needed, and then been released earlier than planned to be able to pursue parenting. But if I chose to stay, then I would have already lost the rights to my child. But I was willing to give up my work assignment, potentially. I was willing to give up my treatment assignment, potentially. I was willing to give up this 3-year plan that I had developed for self-improvement to go out on the off chance that I might win a trial to continue to be a parent to my child. But that was important enough to me at the time that I did so. But people aren't guaranteed success when they go out, but you are guaranteed that you may not have what you left when you come back. So,
can you just walk people through the process of what it actually means to do what you did and the steps that you had to go through and somewhat of what the consequences to you were?
Yes. So I waited 2.5 years for an opportunity to get into this AIP treatment. I went to treatment 2 months early, and it was a staging bed where I was guaranteed my spot, but I had to wait there in the treatment program, but I knew I was in. When I got the notice about my termination of parental rights, I had to choose to potentially give up that spot in treatment. I had to choose to give up the highest paying job in prison is $77.90 a month, and I had to choose to potentially lose that job, which would mean any financial support I had for myself while incarcerated. When I did choose to go, I was brought to the intake center at 4 a.m. I was transported to Portland, Oregon. I sat in a holding cell, horribly, horribly gross conditions for, I don't know, hours and hours. I was given a pretty much rotten breakfast, still in a holding cell with people coming in off the street, detoxing people, all kinds of stuff. I left at 4 a.m. I did not get to my cell for overnight until 9 p.m., which is literally from Wilsonville to Southeast Portland, because I was housed at Inverness Jail, but I had to go through downtown, and I was in holding cells, transported around all day long. I finally got to a holding cell at 9 p.m. The very next morning at 5 a.m., I was shackled up in a jumpsuit, taken back downtown to Portland, and transported to the juvenile courthouse, where I was stuck in a little tiny room with a glass door where people can walk by and see you in shackles for the hours that you're waiting for court to start. And then when court does start, as opposed to criminal trials, you're not allowed to be in jail attire while you're on trial. You have to be in street clothes. But when it comes to a juvenile court trial, you are shackled, you're shuffling in jailhouse slippers, you're in this jumpsuit with neon colored jumpsuit and writing, and you have to go before the judge and all these people that are there to tell you how horrible you are, all these poor decisions you made, how your children have suffered because of your decisions, and how you're not fit to be their parent, you know, ongoing, and you're supposed to stand up for your rights and fight for your child and try to convince this whole panel of people that say that you're worthless and that you're trash and everything, that you are good enough and you do deserve another opportunity to parent the human being that you brought into this world. And for someone who isn't fortified in the conviction that they can do it despite all odds, it's such an overwhelming experience. And 3 days, May 9th will be my 3 years since I've been released, and I still have emotional reactions when I remember that day. And when I finally got there, they told me if I was willing to sign a paper that said that I agreed that if any time during the first 3 months while I was out, if I missed a UA, if I missed a class, if I had a probation violation, I would automatically forfeit the right to my child for the rest of his life. If I was willing to sign that paper, then they would drop the petition to terminate my rights and I could go back to the prison and continue the rest of my time. And I signed that paper knowing that in my heart that I had a conviction that I was going to be successful in that journey, but you never know. It could be a matter of two buses not meeting up at the same time, and then you're, you know, in your route to do a UA, you've missed the window, and there goes your parental right. So I was definitely half an hour early for anything I did for those first 3 months, and it's carried on to the next 3 years. But it's as simple as that. One false move or one poor decision, you know, someone can be overwhelmed in that room full of attorneys and you have that paper in front of you and they sign something overwhelmed and pressured in the moment and regret it for the rest of their life. And to be in that position, in that environment, and having to deal with life decisions with no support, it's not something I would wish on anyone.
How did your work with the Family Preservation Project support you through this process or help you in facing these difficult decisions?
They were there every time I had a question, every time I doubted what my next step should be, or when I had an emotional reaction to a paper that I was handed or a letter I got saying, oh, my son's being moved here, or oh, we found a family for him. And I would, you know, as a mother, emotionally break down. They were always there to encourage me and pull me back together. And it, like I said, they were that avenue of communication that without which I wouldn't have been able to pursue and be as confident in the decisions that I made as I move forward in my own termination case. Not everyone has access to that. A majority of the women, significant majority of the women there do not have access to that. And when you're trying to detox, when you're trying to figure out who you are, when you're going through your lowest of the low point in your life, being incarcerated and alone, to have someone there that cares and understands where you're coming from and is willing to listen to you and support you through that is the difference of night and day.
If you're just tuning in now, you're listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Isabel Sinclair, and I'm here with representatives from the Family Preservation Project and Ebony Howard, a formerly incarcerated mother. Heather, Jessica, in your work with the Family Preservation Project, what do you normally see in women that come for help, and how much help can you give to people who are incarcerated? Like Ebony spoke a little bit that a lot of people don't receive the help that they need, so who can receive it and how does that work?
I think first, I generally, when I talk to moms, I talk to them about the fact that I'm not there to help them, I'm there to serve them, because the women are the ones doing most of this work. All we do as staff with the Family Preservation Project is dial the phone, and I buy tissue in bulk at Costco so that we always have nice tissue. But the moms are in there every day calling the people that they need to call. They're calling their legal counsel, they're calling DHS, they're calling their caregivers, they're calling their children. They're signing their kids up for summer camp. They're finding out what their hobbies are. They're asking their children what they're interested in, and we're ordering books to go directly to the house. They're providing support for potty training from the office, right? We have one little girl right now who we sent a huge pack of bottoms and a big bag of Skittles, and her mom called home and said, you know, we're going to do one Skittle for peeing and two for going potty otherwise. And she's been doing really well. And she came to our last visit and she had like three successful potty training episodes. And the family's providing a lot of really great support and feedback around that. But it's all the moms doing it from the office. As far as who has access to these services, I have a small cohort. I do the more clinically intensive. So I meet with the women each an hour a week. We also have class twice a week. We have visitation with the kids twice a month. That's full contact visitation for 3 hours. They get to make crafts with their mom. They get to have two meals with their mom. They get to play outside and blow bubbles. And to qualify for that program, there was criteria set forth by the department and in conjunction with Ms. Katz when the program reopened. And they have to do with driving proximity, because we don't want children to be in the car when they come to visits for more than 2 hours each way. And then also the women have to have a certain amount of time left so that they can participate in the program. But that's why the Family Resource Center was created, is so that even women who don't qualify for the intensive program still have access to an advocate that can help them make phone calls and file paperwork and do all of these other things.
So it sounds like, to sum it up a little bit, that some of the work the Family Preservation Project does is to act as a middleman between mothers and their families to help increase opportunity for communication and access that otherwise would not be available to mothers on the inside.
Totally, yes. I think you summed it up well, and also with the lens always being around children's well-being, so like to not lose sight of that. We are actively working with moms, we're trying to remove barriers, but also I think that because we built this, we created this problem, we have an obligation to also solve the problem. And it is, if we don't do anything on behalf of kids of incarcerated parents, then it's a real missed opportunity, because we really have access to them through their moms while they are incarcerated, and we have the ability to really move the dial.
How long has the Family Preservation Project been at Coffee Creek, and how are you funded, and how are you doing in terms of support?
The very first iteration of this program started in 2003, so it's been about 16 years. Throughout that time, we've had multiple funding sources and homes for the program. We are now part of the YWCA of Greater Portland as of 2015, and we are funded through the state legislature in part, and then in part through fundraising by the YWCA. And we have been funded in that way for the last two biennia. And this legislative session, there's a policy bill under consideration, House Bill 3300, that would create a more stable funding stream for the work of the Center for Incarcerated Mothers.
So in the amount of time that we have remaining, I'm wondering if there's anything in addition that any of you would like to share, either about your work with the organization or about experience within Coffee Creek or anything that you would like our listeners to know.
I'd like the listeners to know that even though as incarcerated women, we've made a choice that has been against the law and we're sentenced to a time of incarceration as punishment, that should not have any bearing on our ability to parent our children for the rest of their lives ongoing. I made a poor decision as an individual. I did not make a life-altering decision as a parent. You know, when you give birth to a child, you're a parent for their life, and that's your responsibility to raise that child into, you know, an adult. And we've all made decisions that haven't been the best decisions in our lives. Some of us have gotten caught. Some of us have done times in periods of incarceration, but that doesn't change the fact that we love our children or we care about our families and we want the best for our children. And it doesn't mean that we have given up the opportunity or the capability to be responsible and productive parents moving forward. And I want the women that are incarcerated to know that you're not forgotten, that we do care about you, we do love you, and happy Mother's Day, and know that your children feel the same way too. Your families love and care about you, and just because you're doing a period of punishment doesn't mean that you are no longer a mother. You are a mother for your life.
I definitely second that. A shout out to all the mothers currently incarcerated in this state or others. Know that you're very much thought of and in someone's heart. Ours particularly as well.
And I want the incarcerated mothers to also know that you're good enough, you're capable enough, you're strong enough, and we're rooting for you.
I think something that I like to remind folks of when I have these conversations with them is that we are often put into kind of idealistic camps, right? And we have like the cult of celebrity and we have all of these ideas that we get really attached to. And we forget that when we talk about incarceration, we're talking about human beings. And when we look at motherhood inside of a prison, we're not only talking about the human beings that are being punished. I love the Ebony, kept using the word punished. But we're also looking at their children, and their children are then being punished, right? Their children are being clothed in the stigma. They're trying to choose when they're at school who they tell. They're trying to get their grades up and their bellies full and their bodies clothed all at the same time as missing their primary caregiver, missing their mother, forming their own identity in conjunction with, if my mother is X and people are constantly telling me that she is X, am I X? You know, am I going to follow her path? And so when we forget about the humanity linked to incarceration, we are abandoning an entire following generation. It's not just the women that we are punishing with this model that we have decided works, regardless of the data. We are also punishing their children. And that's what I've really loved about the work at the Family Preservation Project, is that I get to talk to mothers about what is best for their children, because they know better than anyone, and then apply that and ask the children too, does this sound good? Does this work for you? And I've seen time and time again, I've seen grades raise, I've seen kids engage in extracurricular activities, I've talked to teachers with moms, I've seen children advocate for themselves in court where they wouldn't have before. And I've watched a lot of familial relationships mend between the folks providing care to the children in the absence of the mother and the mom themselves. And even that is an ongoing and long process because of all the hurt and pain that comes with the issues that bring folks to prison in the first place. And so when we have these conversations, I really ask that folks acknowledge that this isn't a crime issue or a punishment issue or a danger issue. This is a humanity issue. And it's how we're formulating the question and what answers we're applying that will make the difference for the folks that are following us as well.
And I just wanted to also say about Ebony's journey, because she doesn't always tell this part of the story, which is like when she sort of runs through what her journey was like and the fight that she had to maintain her rights to be a mom. Like, I've told her this a lot of times, but not everybody has the strength to do what she did, or those are the people that in a moment of extreme distress and sense of like complete abject hopelessness sign a paper away, which is irrevocable. And it happens often, because not everybody has a tremendous amount of grit, which is not to say that those people are lesser. It's just that the reality of what you're up against is incredibly profound. And the prize at the end is that, like, she gets to be a mom day in and day out. It's really hard.
Day in and day out.
Thank you, Ebony, and thank all of you for coming here and being willing to talk about this, for the work that you do, and for the efforts that you've put in for yourself and others.
Thank you so much for creating the forum for us to be here.
Yes, thank you.
You've been listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Lessons for a New Generation of Organizers. A talk with David Rainey on Thursday, May 16th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Ask Me Union Hall in Portland. David Rainey, Professor Emeritus in the College of Urban Planning and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He is also the author of the new book, Living and Dying on the Factory Floor, From Outside In and the Inside Out. The event is also sponsored by the Institute of Anarchist Studies and the Burgerville Workers Union. Again, that's Lessons for a New Generation of Organizers, a talk with David Rainey on Thursday, May 16th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Ask Me Union Hall, 6025 East Burnside Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under